Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire Investigates, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on the top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room going on right now at blogtalkradio.com/crimewire. If you are a friend or a family member and you would like to send the CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you would like to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And tonight with us is Donna Pendergast, prosecutor and Women in Crime Inc. contributor, and Jean Cervantes from Citizens Against Homicide. Take it away, Denny.
Yes, before we get into the case profile for the night, I want to take just a couple of seconds here and announce that CrimeWire has a brand new revamped website. We kicked off today, and we're quite excited about it. It's the URL is www.crimewiresite.com. And on it, you can listen to our Blog Talk radio show. You can answer poll questions, find information about our consultants and friends, read blog postings, and send messages to the CrimeWire team. On the forum pages, you can comment on the cases profiled on the show or start discussion threads on other crime-related issues. We even have a store where you can find books written by Vito, Susan, and me, and a link to CrimeWire merchandise. So we hope basic membership is free. We hope you'll visit the site and register with us and join the discussion and give us some feedback. And I would say the first poll we have posted tonight is about a case we profiled on August 24th regarding the death of John Petruzzulli. And we'd really love to have you go on there and answer the poll questions so we can get some feedback on your perception of the Petruzzulli story.
That's the father who's preserved the car, isn't it not?
Yes, it is.
It is. And he's from South Carolina. North Carolina.
If you didn't hear the show live and want to refresh your memory on it again, it's in the archives under the August 24th show. So please do that. Now, tonight we're going to discuss a case from October 31, 2006. And on that night, officers from the Marlow, Oklahoma Police Department were dispatched to the home of 25-year-old Gary Don Edwards in response to a domestic dispute reported by Gary's wife, Heather. The initial officers to arrive located Gary a short distance from the residence. Police reports of the incident indicate that Gary was in an intoxicated condition. He was arrested for public intoxication, taken to the station, and booked into a holding cell at 6:40 p.m. At 9 p.m., Gary was found hanging from his T-shirt, which was tied to a window grate. However, Donna Edwards and her husband, Gary Sr., weren't convinced that their son had taken his own life. They begin to ask questions and review documents. The family believes their son's death was a homicide. And with us tonight to discuss this case is Gary Edwards, Sr. Gary, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on.
If you would, please, as you heard, gave you a very brief overview of what happened. Would you like to expand on that and take the listeners through the events as you know them of that night in October?
Yes, sir. Well, I was on the way to Houston with my wife for heart surgery, and my son called at a little bit after 7 that night and told us that he had been arrested for public intox. He told us that he was mad that they were stealing his money. So we told him to just get some sleep and that his wife would be there in 4 hours to bond him out of jail. He said, okay, Mom, I love you, and I'll talk to you later. Well, we didn't hear anything the rest of the night, and so the next morning, my wife looked on her caller ID and called the jail to see if he had bonded out of jail. The dispatcher put the chief on the line. The chief said there had been an altercation with our son and that he had hung himself in the jail cell. My wife said, oh, my God, is he all right? And he said, no, ma'am, he's dead. She then handed me the phone. I asked what was going on, and he told me that my son was dead and had been sent to the medical examiner for an autopsy.
Mr. Edwards, can I stop you just a second? I want to make sure I understand this. You're saying that your son, as it turned out, was found dead at around 9 p.m., and you didn't find out about it until the next morning when your wife called the jail to see if he'd been bonded out?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay, and the second thing is you mentioned earlier that he was upset because they were stealing his money, or he thought they were. By they, do you mean the officers or another inmate, or who was stealing his money that he thought?
He was upset that the officers were stealing his money, and that was somewhat corroborated in a police statement that one of the officers issued saying that my son wanted him to observe the counting of his money because he came from Arkansas where they stole money, is the way he put it in the statement.
The officer put that in the statement?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So anyway, so then the following morning, then, you find out that your son is dead, allegedly hung himself in his jail cell. What happened after that? Did you were you suspicious right off the bat, or did you think he really did take his own life, or what was your reaction?
Well, I just couldn't imagine that my son would take his own life. He had no reason to, so I just knew that something wasn't right about the whole thing, and then we just came on back from Houston and made the funeral arrangements. Well, as it turned out, my niece worked at a funeral home and had saw many bodies and some that had died from hanging, and she looked at my son in the casket at the funeral viewing, and she told me that she didn't believe he died from hanging, and he had cuts and bruises on him that was not listed on the autopsy report. And so she took pictures for evidence, and sure enough, when the autopsy came in, it was not on the autopsy report.
Well, they didn't take photographs either, did they, sir, at the autopsy?
As I'm understanding, we called them and talked to them about the photographs. They first said they didn't have any, that their caseload was so heavy that they might not have took any. Then we dug a little deeper, and they changed their story, saying, yes, that they did have some, and they're protected information. We can't get those unless we get a court order.
Can I ask Donna Pendergrass, because, you know, you see a lot of these cases, as somebody that does, is there any advice for those families listening, you know, if they find themselves in these situations immediately, do they have any recourse in you know, getting some things properly autopsied and done, or is it pretty much at the discretion of the ME or, you know, wherever they live?
You know, Susan, unfortunately, what it boils down to is whether or not a family has money or not, because, you know, the family has some recourse. I mean, they can ask the medical examiner, which is a statutorily appointed position. You know, if they're not happy with the answers they're getting, they can ask for a coroner's inquest, but that's very unusual. But to actually dictate, you know, we want an autopsy, we want everything looked at, you pretty much have to pay for a private autopsy. And I've seen many, many families do that. They're not satisfied with the answers they're getting, so they hire their own, medical examiner to, you know, and most of them do consulting on the side to perform a second autopsy, but that's expensive.
But, Vito, we're seeing a lot of these, aren't we? We're seeing a lot of these kind of cases where, you know, the person died who under suspicious death. We almost put on a case a week like this, and also from Oklahoma.
Yeah. You know, Mr. Edwards?
Yes.
Gary Sr.? Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. A couple questions for you, sir. Was there any photos that you know of taken at the cell area where he supposedly hung himself? Did you ever find out?
Yes, sir.
They did take a lot of pictures. Did you ever see them or anybody connected with your family, your attorney or anybody see them?
Yes, sir. There was supposedly been three sets of photos taken. We obtained, I think, about 15 photos, and they were out of sequence. There was, I believe, five photos missing. Okay. The ones that we have that show my son in the cell, the T-shirt goes right up under his chin and right behind his ear and the knot where the T-shirt was supposedly tied around his neck was all the way at the crown of his head, and it wasn't touching the back of his neck anywhere. And that was one thing that our forensic expert had commented on, that it didn't leave a classic V bruise that it should have left.
Right.
And what was drawn on the traumagram from the medical examiner was a mark completely encircling his neck.
Okay. Okay, now help me out with this, sir. I want to see if this is right what I'm reading here. It's the part where it's saying that the phone was given over to Officer James Price, who informed Donna, your wife, right, that Gary would be released in 4 hours. Was that what was said to her?
Yes.
Okay, now, what I'm confused about, most police departments I know, and every state is different, and every police department is different, and Donna may weigh in on what she feels out her way. But I know around our police departments here, I haven't heard of anything. In other words, they don't do this anymore. Well, you're drunk, go sleep it off. Either you're arrested or you're not arrested. And if you're arrested and there's no bond, over here we call it a PTA, a promise to appear, or if you're that bad, drunk or whatever, we're going to put a $500 bond on you. By the time the morning comes, somebody will get you out. I don't understand the thing here of telling somebody, okay, yeah, we're going to let him go in, 4 hours. I mean, I don't understand that. Donna, how is it where you're from?
Yeah, no, pretty much the same way, and I was confused when I read about that as well. Unless they had some inside information that the wife was going to get there to bond him out in 4 hours, but there's been no indication of that thus far. So that was one thing I didn't understand. The other things that struck me as a little bit odd are, number one, they have to call to see if he's bonded out, only to be informed that he's dead.
Right.
You know, that strikes me as funny. And it also strikes me, just backing up for a minute, something that was said a little bit earlier, why in God's name did the medical examiner, hedge about having autopsy photographs? I mean, that is a statutorily created position. Everything they do is public record. And, you know, why are they saying we don't have photographs, and then they come back and say, oh, yeah, well, we do? I mean, there's just a lot of things that don't seem to make sense here.
Mr. Edwards, well, when you started asking questions, when you became suspicious, I know that this you eventually got a hold of a booking sheet or paperwork at the police station when your son was booked in, saying that he had no injuries. Am I correct that the booking document said that he was injury-free when he was booked in? Yet you're saying these injuries, well, they weren't actually reported on the autopsy, but they were observed during the funeral process, during the wake process. Were any injuries reported at all from the autopsy? If not all of them, were some injuries reported at the autopsy?
There was some that were recorded on the autopsy. He had one on his left hand that was pretty severe, and some bruising, and we questioned that, and also we had pictures to back up what we had, and we questioned the medical examiner on that, and this was the reply that we got, was the bad cut that was on his left hand was because they incised it to see if it was lividity or bruising. And then in the next sentence, it says that in their photos that they have, it clearly shows that it was free of trauma. Well, I mean, if it was free of trauma, why did they cut it? And if they cut it, why didn't they list it on the autopsy report?
Mr. Edwards, have you found out or had anybody investigate whether this has happened before to other people that were in the cell? You know, through the years, if other inmates, you know, people that were arrested had died this way?
Well, we have, yes, and you pretty much get the same runaround as we have gotten. We have asked the district attorney on many occasions and sent him new evidence pertaining to the place and arrest of my son. They gave a story saying he was arrested at a convenience store, and then they gave the investigator from the ME's office a different story saying that he was arrested at home.
So what does his cause of death say on the death certificate?
It says hanging, suicide.
Okay. And you went and got a second autopsy?
No, ma'am. We haven't been able to afford to get another autopsy. But I had all of the documents, the autopsy report, and all the police statements and everything reviewed by a forensic scientist, and he recommended that be done, but he also recommended I give it to the OSBI and the district attorney for a new investigation.
And what were you told?
And I was told by the district attorney just last week that there has been no evidence presented to him to say that there was a crime committed.
Hold on a minute. Gene Cervantes from Citizens Against Homicide, weigh in on this, will you please?
Well, you know, I would tend to believe that there's enough information to open an investigation. One, you got some police corruption and self-admitted police corruption by stealing money from prisoners. You also have the review by the private forensic scientist that would give somebody with any reasonable amount of intelligence cause to open an investigation, believing that this is an educated individual, he's got a doctor's degree, and why not open it up and, if there's doubt, just dismiss doubt, you know, get rid of all the doubt and say we've got a bona fide case of suicide, or no, we don't, we have a bona fide case of homicide or foul play.
And there's a new bill that just passed in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Where a third party now can come in, signed by the governor. If Delilah from Imagine Publicity is listening, if she could put it up on the site, in the chat room, it's a newly created bill where if you are an outside party, and they didn't allow this before up until this year, you can go in and, you know, investigate it. I mean, you can get some outside sources. You can get a third party other than the ME to look at this. And maybe there's some suggestions we can come up with. I think that, Mr. Edwards, you should contact, or we can try to contact with you, the 11thcommandment.org, which is on the Sheila Davini case, the Turner case, the Horton case, on all these discrepancies. And perhaps, I think, if Denny and Vito, you'll agree, perhaps, that that is the best place for action for this case that's sitting in limbo.
Right. That is very true. And Gary, I'd just like to ask you one other question, too, on this. The company that you hired to do an independent forensic examination, they had issued a report critical of the investigation. Now, what did they exactly say, sir? What's a couple of the things that they said? Do you remember?
Yes, they said the investigation was inadequate. It was taken at face value and not examined or investigated, and that he said the in his paragraph in the forensic examination, it says that the ligature mark was more consistent with a homicidal strangulation versus a hanging. I mean, hanging.
Sure.
So,
and what did the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation do or say to you or anybody when they received this report?
We contacted them. They said that their law says that they cannot conduct an investigation unless asked by the police agency or the district attorney. We also went to the multi-grand jury investigation unit.
Okay.
They said that basically the same thing, that they can't do anything unless requested by the ME or a police outside agency. They
right.
can't
did
do
any,
it for an
you,
individual.
Did your independent report that you received, did that go in the media, in the papers or anything?
No, we didn't put it. It was on a Channel 9 news out there,
okay.
But we didn't disclose any of the information in the report. We just stated that we had a report and it contained flaws.
Well, Susan, Jean, and all of our people here, I mean, this is becoming so commonplace, and I know I kidded around a couple weeks ago when I said Oklahoma is not okay, but it's a true statement. They got a serious, serious problem out there.
Well, we have a good group that started out of all these cases as well. Go ahead, Donna.
Yeah, Susan, I was going to say, and the one thing that people, are ignoring here is the glaring white elephant in the room, and that is the why. I mean, this is a young man, 25 years old. He's arrested on a minor charge. There is no reason here why he would commit suicide. I mean, there's no indication of any kind of mental depression. He was set to be released, the four-hour thing we've all puzzled about. Whether it was 4 hours or the next morning doesn't matter. It's like, this is just, a chump change charge. He's going to be released. Why in God's name is he going to commit suicide? It doesn't make any sense.
In addition to that, he tells his mom, I love you, I'll see you tomorrow. Or talk with you tomorrow. And, I need to go back to the fact, to the statement that, with money, people can get a case opened. That's not necessarily true in most cases, because what I call circling the wagons, law enforcement agencies within a specific jurisdiction will circle the wagons and they'll start protecting one another. And I find that appalling, but that's the reality of it. My other question would be, Mr. Edwards, did he have any DNA under his fingernails?
They didn't even state that on the autopsy, if he did or did not. I know that given the position he was in, that from the pictures that we saw and that we have, one's body bodily functions release, as I'm understanding, and he had no kind of stains in his clothes, and we questioned, you know, that, and they said that they had not been laundered. They had they were given to us just as they took them off the body. And we had those looked at by this forensic expert also, and he took photos of them under UV light and with and without a UV light, and he said they needed to be tested for blood in the area of the front left front pocket. And there was no mention of blood anywhere in any of anybody's reports. And then also the T-shirt, we were trying to get a hold of it to have it forensic tested. And they told us from the medical examiner's office that it might have laid around there a couple of days and they threw it in the trash.
Gary, let me ask you, I've got a copy of this the independent forensic scientist report here, and at the end, he makes five recommendations. Now, you just talked about the one, the decedent's genes should be tested for blood in the area of the left front pocket. But let's take the other four one at a time and tell us the status of those if you did anything based on these recommendations. It says, this report and related documentation be given to OSBI, which is the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, for further investigation. Now, you indicated you did do that, but that kind of hit a dead end there. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the next go ahead.
We gave it to the OSBI, and that's about as far as it went.
The second recommendation, the estate of Mr. Edwards should request of OSBI that his body be disinterred for a second independent autopsy. Should they be unwilling to meet this request, the estate should seek out their own independent forensic pathologist to perform a second autopsy on their behalf. Now, you say that one, the state, the OSBI declined, and it's a financial thing now, am I correct, because you would have to do this yourself?
Yes, sir.
Would you be willing to do it if you had the money or the finance?
Yes, sir. I would.
Okay. Number three, the estate of Mr. Edwards should make a written request for all photos in this case, death scene and autopsy alike, to the district attorney's office citing this report. Have you made the request to the DA for all photos?
Yes, we have. And we filed a lawsuit, and we opted to settle it out of court because of the Governmental Tort Claims Act. Long story short, we asked in discovery about some things, the photos and the audio tapes of the calls that were in and out of the station that night. We didn't get any. They said they didn't exist. The only photos we got was the one set. Where the other two sets went, I have no idea.
Okay, and the fourth recommendation, the estate of Mr. Edwards should make a written request for all photos and evidence in the custody of the ME's office, including the missing shirt. I assume he's talking about the T-shirt that Gary Jr. allegedly hung himself with. And how does that stand from the ME's office? Did you get everything from them that you asked for?
No, sir. That is protected information. They would not give it to us. They said that we had to get a judge to sign that, a form, and I turned it over to my attorney. As I'm understanding, there has to be an open case in order for the judge to sign that, and then it has to go to the Attorney General for approval before it is sent to the ME, before they will release any of that.
So, now this case, though, is not open, right? It's a closed case, as closed as a suicide, am I right?
Yes.
And unless you can get somebody to reopen it, then you wouldn't meet the criteria to get the evidence from the ME's office. Am I following this right?
That's my understanding.
So as long as they refuse to reopen this case, which is an active investigation, you're stuck.
Yes, sir.
He's stuck for now. Again, with all the success of the 11th Commandment and what they're doing in Oklahoma, after the show or by tomorrow morning, I'll get him the information. They can hook up, and they will go ahead, Mr. Edwards, and direct you and assist you with what you need right there in Oklahoma, because that's the only way to get some of these things done with the, you know, orders being signed. I mean, because they've been through so many of these cases that we've had on the show already, and they've been quite effective.
Well, the only other option we have is if a new district attorney comes into office, then we can present it to...
What county are you in?
In Oklahoma?
Yes.
Or I'm in Arkansas.
Oh, okay. But the county of the case? The case for the county?
Stevens County.
Okay. Again, it you know, persistence is everything, and this group has taken on in Oklahoma, you know, a real better than an 1850 style justice. So I suggest, like I said, after the show, I will get a hold of them. I will give them your telephone number. They will call you probably tomorrow, and you begin to start the process with them. I feel comfortable that they would at least get answers and things done for you that haven't been done thus far, because they're right there, so they could be your eyes and ears in a way.
And Susan?
Okay. Yes,
Susan,
sir.
Just to close this bit, I was out in Oklahoma at the beginning of May and visiting some people I know, and their words, everybody I talked to, was that this state, meaning Oklahoma, has the worst old boy network in the entire country. Okay.
Well, maybe you guys will let me call in when I'm there in October, and I'll be the segment.
You
know,
be careful out there.
Oh, I take good money to see it, Susan.
Well, I'm going to be out there for 2 weeks, from the 14th to the end of the month. So if I could, you know, call in, maybe that's a good segment for the show, because I'm going to be there on the Turner case, the Horton case, and the Devinny case. So,
okay.
Watch out, Oklahoma.
in heels, pretty high, 6-inch heels.
you go, girl.
Mr. Edwards, is there anything else that you'd like to say before we close the segment about the case and what you hope other parents who are listening and family members can do that perhaps you learned during this painful process?
Well, I would just like to say that don't believe that it's a suicide if something happens to one of their loved ones until they dig and get all the information that they need. And then once again, I would like to say thank you for everybody that's helping on this, and especially you guys.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very
much. You're welcome. And like I said, the 11thcommandment.org will be in contact with you tomorrow. I'll pass on. I've got your number here. We'll pass it on, and hopefully we'll have you back for a follow-up saying that the ME's decision on the death certificate has been changed.
Susan, I believe there's another website, justiceforthedead.com.
It is. It's the same group.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're that's the one that they're pretty much promoting for these cases, the casework
right.
that they're doing. So, okay. Thank you, Mr. Edwards, and God bless you.
And thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary.
Susan, I just close up by saying, you know what, being a prosecutor as I have, I'm starting my 24th year next week, and, you know, tenacity is everything. I mean, it is these victims' families that keep it alive and keep it in the, you know, in the public attention. And, you know, I've had 3 different cases that have been, you know, over 35 years old that because somebody refused to give up, that ultimately, you know, there was a day in court. So, you know, the tenacity of the families really means everything in these cases.
You're staying on with us, right, Donna?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, good. Okay, good. You know, we have some good news tonight. On July 21st, 2007, the Furlong family was in the living room of their home in Willows, California, when a 59-year-old Bud walked into the house badly burned. Skin was falling off his arms. His son, Kurt, drove him 10 miles to the Willows Hospital. Bud told Kurt that he had gone into a nearby duck cabin on the family compound to use the restroom. When he opened the front door of the cabin, it blew, knocking him back off his feet. Bud was in the air, lifted to Davis's Medical Center in Sacramento, where he died earlier the next day. Today, we have an update on this case, and joining us with the Sacramento Valley Mirror is reporter Tim Cruz. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how are you?
Good, sir. What's going on with the case?
Well, we had the coroner's inquest here August 30th and, 30th and 31st. It had been projected for 2.5 days. It concluded at 2 days, and the vote of the coroner's jury, the first coroner's jury here in probably 40 years, was homicide. Lieutenant Colonel Fogelsong retired. Had first been the sheriff had first decided that it was suicide, that he had taken a can of gasoline and poured it on his head. Then they changed that when that became just too absurd to believe. They changed the ruling of the cause of death to accident. And we did a number of stories. The family pushed very hard. We've done 49 stories now. But the important thing here is the family can get some relief from the cause of death being changed from accident to homicide. It was not a unanimous vote of the jury, and I was distressed personally because the Fogelsong family had asked for 10 witnesses. They were allowed 2 family members, and they had one expert, Terry Taylor, who's colleague of a fellow named Dr. John D. DeHaan, who's considered the world's foremost authority on these kinds of fires. They scheduled the inquest when the foremost authority would not be available, truncated the testimony, allowed very little of the family's evidence to come in, and still the vote was homicide. Tremendous relief for the Fogelsong family. But now the question is finding the killer. Dr. DeHaan said simply that, if I can read briefly 3 sentences, in the opinion of the undersigned, the investigations carried out by public and private agencies were woefully inadequate to support any conclusions in an equivocal fire death case such as this one. A conclusion that Mr. Fogelsong was solely responsible for the fire and subsequently his own death is not supported by the evidence. At this time, it appears most likely that a fire was started deliberately inside the building with gasoline prior to his arrival, and when he entered the building to investigate, inhaling smoke-laden air and introducing enough fresh air to support a backdraft, the event engulfed him. So that's where we are now.
Can I ask you, you know, there's a lot of families and people listening right now. How important is it when a reporter takes the time, such as yourself, sir, to cover the story 49, 50 times? So how much weight does that play when these things go?
Yeah, even though we're larger, the 2 twice weeklies in the county, where our circulation is 29, 50, and there is a large corporate owned daily across the river that services this area. You know, so there's a certain degree of mockery, but if you are true to your craft and stubborn, and you can keep the story out there long enough to keep people discussing it, it certainly helps. The other part of it is, with us doing this, is I'm 67. I've been doing this a while, and we were able to find a slew of people who had worked with the victim. Colleagues from the Air Force, colleagues from his commercial aircraft career, friends, people, and they all said that the idea that he would set this fire was completely out of character. Commercial airline pilots in general are not unstable. This guy was a retired U.S. Air Force tanker pilot. He knew a lot about petroleum-based fires. What startled me about it, and what really intrigued me, was the standard procedure for the CHP, the California Highway Patrol, in a fatal, where there's any question at all of what happened, is to go back 72 hours, find out what was going on in the person's life. No one made any attempt to do that. No one made any attempt to address the fact that after Colonel Fogelsong saw his son off for his third tour in the Mideast as a Marine Corps helicopter pilot. He spent the entire day with his daughter-in-law and granddaughter, the apple of his eye. And the only reason they were not all together when he went to the other end of the compound about a mile away was because the baby was hungry and was his daughter-in-law and the baby were going to join him in a few minutes. When you discover those kinds of things, when you learn something about the nature of a victim, when a newspaper does that and you're able to portray the victim three-dimensionally, I believe it helps the public to understand the nature and circumstances of an event. Without that, you know, you're just dealing with essentially a two-dimensional a photograph. You're not dealing with a human being. So to answer your question, I think that the small, the people who are reporters, who are journalists at papers of any size can be a tremendous help. And the problem with dealing with bigger papers is there's generally too many layers to dig through to get to somebody who's willing to spend the time.
Well, thank you for coming on. Thank you, Tim Cruz with the Sacramento Valley Mirror, for updating on this important case and keeping up with you, sir.
We'll keep you in the loop.
All right. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye, Dan. Thank you, sir.
Susan, can I add something? This is Gene again.
Yes, sir.
When Bud's case was aired several weeks ago, I believe it was Vito asked, what do you want out of this? And I said, a decision by the coroner's inquest that it was something other than suicide or accidental, and we want an investigation.
Right.
That's all we want, and now it's going to happen. So,
you notice what he said, though. I forgot how many dozens of stories that were
49. Written. He said 49.
See that? I'm a big proponent on that whenever people have a chance to do that. That makes a big difference. You know?
Well,
it's also his age.
He's,
you know, he's a veteran.
Job.
He's a veteran. He's been around. This guy served his country. He deserves no less, period.
That's right.
And, Susan, not only that, I mean, you have to look at who this guy was. Not only is he retired lieutenant colonel, I mean, this is a guy with a master's degree in national security affairs. I mean, he's fluent in Arabic and French. I mean, this is, you know, an off-the-scale person.
That's right.
You know, an outstanding citizen. I mean, the type of person, he's a hero.
That's right.
And, you know, all of a sudden you've got people slandering his reputation by saying that he went in and maybe he snapped and, like, burnt this place down, and he, you know, got burned in the process. I mean, that's crazy. You've not only just brushed murder under the rug, you've just slandered the reputation of a U.S. hero.
That's right.
And maybe this is a good crime post for women in crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
Donna, didn't you mention a few minutes ago that tenacity is the key?
It is the key. There's no
question. Clearly, this is an example. 49 stories and the efforts of the family and the Gene's group, Citizens Against Homicide, and these people stuck to their guns and didn't give up. And their tenacity is paying off. So I commend all of them for hanging in there until the job got done.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, most
yet.
Victims don't have somebody that can do 49 stories on their, you know, individual cases.
Okay, Mr. Vito.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about this case. Very, very interesting case that is getting more and more reports across the country. Let me read this. I like our listeners, especially the ladies, to listen to this about this guy here. Randall Mason, age 28, was arrested August 18th by Greenwich, Connecticut police officers after being taken into custody by the Cook County, Illinois Sheriff's Fugitive Task Force. He was transported back to Connecticut. He was arraigned on 7 counts each of threatening and harassment, and there's much more charges coming across the country on this. Mr. Mason would date women he met on the Internet, Craigslist, and then would repeatedly threaten the women after the relationship ended. He would even go as far as to call their workplaces, threatening them, threaten their coworkers. When one girlfriend ended their relationship, he harassed her with all the phone calls. He even made so many calls to her workplace that she wound up being fired. It was mass chaos over there. what this man has done, he hacks into his ex-girlfriend's workplace email systems. He monitors any correspondence between her and anybody. He uses a company's telephone routing system to make outgoing calls so the victim would mistake his calls for that of an employer. This guy is bad news, and the only reason this is not a high-profile nationwide case featured on television right now is, thank God, he has not killed somebody right now. And I've been doing a lot of research on this guy, and police departments, the FBI is involved, and they're all comparing notes. Right now he's on about a $250,000 bond, but he has a criminal history that dates back to 2001.
He's a young guy.
Yeah, he has served time in jail. I mean, you know, basically what this guy is doing, he'll go on Craigslist, hook up with a lonely woman. I hate to say it that way. Craigslist is not Match.com, ladies. You know, this is Craigslist.
Match.com I don't think is any good either.
Well,
you know.
But whatever, I don't know. But I'm saying Craigslist, if there's a list of 100
okay.
of places.
Yeah, but Match.com is the older version of a Craigslist in a sense. I mean, I think what's that other one, Donna? Well, there's where they at least do more. I mean, there's no back – Match.com, like I said, that's an older version of trouble.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's
just
an upper-class thing of Craigslist, and people should just be careful, period.
Now, right now, he has done this to 7 or 8 women, but the police departments across the country are meeting, talking, comparing notes, and it keeps getting added to every day. So like I said, I mean, you know, Craigslist is a horrible thing, first of all. Okay, that's horrible. Now, you know, where it falls in the line of these other horrible ones, that's not a good place to meet anybody. And he's left a laundry list across the country. This guy threatens bodily harm and does every – I mean, he torments the women with an abuse that I've never seen, and I was a cop from the late 1960s, and it's the only reason, like I said, that we don't know this guy's name, and I hope we never know his name across the country, is that, number one, he's arrested right now, and number two, he has not killed anybody yet.
But how much time could somebody like that get, Donna, really, before he's back out?
Well, really, no time. I mean, unless you can charge him criminally as a stalker, which, you know, every state has different laws, and under Michigan it's, you know, any two circumstances of unwanted contact. But, you know, even then, in Michigan, anyways, we have sentencing guidelines, and his first offense, you know, his guidelines are going to be 0 to 6 months.
And he's done it in different states, so it's not an interstate
well,
they're going to be able to put
them
together.
That's the problem. You got jurisdiction problems here with the different states. Who gets it first? Who gets it last? You know, the defense attorney, a smart defense attorney, will play games and keep this going forever. But his client is in jail, sitting on a fairly large bond, so he at least is in jail.
For now, though, I mean, you know, in a year, we're going to be reading about this bozo somewhere coming after somebody else and disguising himself, dyeing his hair, and showing up someplace else. Is that possible?
Well,
it's scary behavior, Susan.
It's very scary. Right now, the good news is that he is arrested, and the municipalities are all working together. The bad news is that this guy is serious. I mean, you know, this is coming from my area. I have spoken to the police departments in Connecticut here, and they say this guy is one of the worst, considering he hasn't even killed anybody yet. To tap into phones
that you know of.
That's true. To tap into email systems, phones, correspondence, outgoing calls, he screws up the whole
thing. Can I ask
system.
You, Vito, does he have a certain preference of a woman? You know.
Yeah. In his listings, he's always asked for a full-figured woman. Now, what is that? Is that somebody that could be considered more heavy set? Could that be big breasted? I don't know. I don't know what he's looking for. But all of the women almost look identical, is what I was told. Okay, so he looks for a certain type of woman. Obviously, somebody that women have broken up with him once they did a background check and found out his criminal history and what he has done in the past. But then they think it's over. That's when everything starts with this man. Just when they think, oh, I bid this guy Randall goodbye. Well, not really, because he's a real sicko, and I hope we never see him as a high-profile case. I'm telling you.
I think
what
that's
do
all
you ladies,
you guys
Donna, being a prosecutor, a guy like this comes through your courthouse and you sit there and you read the stuff that I read about this guy and everything else, what are you feeling? I mean, you feel like, man, what can I get this guy on, you know?
You know what? These are the cases where my radar goes up instantly because this is the type of behavior, as you guys all know, that escalates. And it's just like, this is obviously a person with extreme emotional and mental problems who, you know, has now established a pattern, you know, an MO of targeting vulnerable women. And then, you know, basically, I mean, he's a predator, basically, you know, targeting them and then, you know, trying to keep them captive by his behavior. And, you know, unfortunately, there's all too many vulnerable victims out there that originally think, you know, yeah, this sounds like a nice guy, and then they find themselves trapped in a terrible situation. One bright light in this I want to bring up to everybody, though, because it's a very recent development. It just happened yesterday. But a number of attorney generals across the nation, including my boss, Mike Cox, who is the attorney general of Michigan, sued Craigslist. Well, didn't sue them, threatened to sue, asking them. They felt that, you know, all the adult services section of their of Craigslist, you know, was nothing more but, you know, really a conduit for a lot of bad things that could take place. And Craigslist, as of yesterday, agreed to eliminate that section of their service. So, you know, the more pressure that we can put on some of these, you know, mediums that, you know, introduce, you know, psycho, like we're talking about, to, you know, the vulnerable victim, the better.
And how many more? Not only that, Donna and Susan, I've talked to some prosecutors that are not on the case, that are friends of mine, and they go to lunch with the judges, of course, and all that kind of stuff. And they have heard about this case because part of it is local. And they have said, man, I wouldn't want that case, and the judges don't want this case because what if you make the wrong decision with this guy? Because this guy is a time bomb waiting to actually kill somebody. And a prosecutor, is, at least the ones I know, Donna, are saying, man, I'm glad that case wasn't assigned to me because what am I going to do if he winds up getting out in 3 months and kills somebody? And I'm going to be on Bill O'Reilly. I'm going to be on Bill O'Reilly next
federal.
Week.
You know what? Isn't there a federal coming up? Has been done already? And
well, the FBI is about. Yes.
Okay, so then there's a federal mandate there that they can actually probably incorporate. The prosecutors can probably get together, figure out who's got the strongest charges, also go federally with it, and then he's at least doing 8-9 years based on what they can put together, I would think.
No, the problem is, Susan, the federal cases take a lot longer to put together, so what happens in the time it takes them, the years, so to put a case together, he's still out there, and he's still victimizing vulnerable victims.
So they put a bond enough on him, and they get a grand jury to indict him. I think that they could move a little bit quickly based on what, because the groundwork should be laid by each of the states that he was already in when he tried to victimize the women.
Yeah, but the coordination between agencies, it takes a lot.
Well, then you and I need to go and take care of it. We could just do it. I mean, that's just make it easier.
That's right.
Let's develop our own unit. This is ridiculous. I mean,
you know,
just put those heels on and we'll go for it.
Okay.
The women, though, listening to this, they need to understand with their friends that they know are involved on these sites and everything else. They need to understand that, you know, you got to check out your parties. I don't care how you do it, whether you're hire a PI to do a background check, whether you just make some phone calls or do something. You can't hook up without any background in an individual. And the guy spends the night at your house and you wind up dead the next day.
How about these people? Maybe they had small children. I mean, are people that so desperate that they're not going to find out who they're meeting, they're not going to check it out with other people? I don't understand that they would just open the door to their homes and let strangers in who, you know.
Yeah. So far, somebody asked on the blog what states are involved so far. So far, the women from New York State, Connecticut, and Illinois. But that's all we know so far. The authorities are all matching, getting together.
Maybe there's more that are embarrassed by what happened and just don't.
Well, of course.
want to come forward. How much do we see of that all the time?
Well, that's why I thought this was very important to get out tonight, because it is a sort of a happy ending right now, for now. But people need to know, women need to know, man, know who you're hooking up with. You know, this is brutal.
You know, and Susan, I'm the head of the computer predator unit in the Attorney General's office. And I got to tell you, I mean, I see this stuff every day. You know, you never know. A computer is anonymous. And, you know, it's not only the kids. And the Attorney General in Michigan, he has a big program targeted on know who your kids are talking to and make sure you know their passwords, this and that. But there's a lot of vulnerable adults out there, too.
Well,
and,
imagine, Donna. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and, you know, with a computer, you just never know who's on the other end of it. I mean,
you know,
everything is anonymous, and
it's one thing to pick up the phone and yell at you, okay, and be abusive towards you. I'm going to kill you and something like that. But this guy, like I know I said it before, but this guy takes the time to hack into her email at home, hack into her workplace email, monitors all of her correspondence, tapes everything, does this. I mean, this guy puts a lot of time in to get back at you. And that's the thing that scares me the most, you see?
Oh,
and look at how many people, look at how many people that we don't know about yet.
Right.
That aren't captured on things in you know, various forms. I mean, computers have the ability now. There's a way you can change IPs. There's a way, if you're very smart and you're techie enough, you can change it out so it's going to fool even the FBI, because it's like a VIN number, and the VIN number can be changed, or it can be registered a certain way, or you're seeing a lot of people home build these computers.
Yeah,
so
a lot of the bloggers are saying that they're so glad that this information was shared, and we got somebody that says they while we're talking, they checked and 24 states got this guy's name on it. So, you know, and somebody's calling him a brilliant psycho. I mean, you know, he's a psycho, that's for darn sure, you know. But right now he's in jail, so that he's not that brilliant. We got him in jail, so that's the good part.
Again, but it's a short-lived thing. I mean, Denny, what do you think?
Yeah.
I mean, this is not... In your day,
not
I'm trying to date
one,
you.
I know.
But in your day, you know, I mean, you've got grandkids, you've got kids. How do you think the computer has helped? I mean, it's helped with the cases that we do, but it also preys on victims, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a two-edged sword, if you will. It's got a lot of positives, but there are negatives with it, and. You know, the negatives, you get your negatives in the sense that people can use scams over the Internet to fleece you out of your money. They can do identity theft activities and all that. And then they've got the personal stuff where like we're talking about here, where it's not a financial crime, where they're actually out to find victims for physical abuse, sexual abuse, murder, whatever it is. And I think a lot of the people who use the Internet, they might know how to use the computer and be proficient at it, but they don't understand, I don't think, that there are predators out there.
And just by putting simple photos of your family and different things, this didn't happen very long where I had somebody, I said, take everything down. She goes, well, I only have family and friends that see it. I said, you cannot block out those photos. Take them down. If people are listening... Do not put photos up on your of your kids and different things. And pardon me, but there are prosecutors out there, Donna, prosecutors who should know better, who have pictures of their kids, like it's okay, and it's not okay, in my opinion. When I see this, it's not okay.
Susan, think of it this way: we all board up and lock up our doors and our windows because we don't want bad men from the night to get into our houses.
They're already there.
Computer is this insidious little thing where people are coming into our houses and we're letting them.
That's right.
Hey, Susan, let's get
a
comment if Gene Cervantes is still on about this before we run out of time.
Well, I'm still here, Vito. My biggest concern, you know, I could just echo what's already been said, but are the children. You know, the predators have a way of worming their way into relationship with a single mother. Next thing you know, they're in the home and with the younger children, and next thing you know, disaster. That would be my big concern. But Like it's already been said, you know, the computers are blessing in disguise, you know, the double-edged sword.
They are. And you know what, everybody, we are out of time. So I want to thank everybody. I want to thank prosecutor and Women in Crime, Inc. contributor Donna Pendergast and Jean Cervantes with Citizens Against Homicide. Thank you to our Crime Wire team, Kim Colton and Public Relations at ImaginePublicity.com, Delilah, who also put together that fabulous new website at thecrimewiresite.com. So everybody please visit it. Our next show will be Tuesday, September 21st, Vito, 2010. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
And thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And you can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show by going to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night and God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Susan Murphy Milano, Donna Pendergast, and Gene Cervantes. God bless.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.